and our final guest today has written about the Lost Girls, four women from Blitz-era London. He's here to tell us all about them. Welcome to the show, DJ Taylor.
Very good to be with you.
Good to have you on the show. Now, who were they then? Who were these women?
The Lost Girls. It makes them sound like sort of fallen women of the Victorian era, you know, sort of been thrown out of the family home and because they were going to have a legitimate baby. In fact, the Lost Girls was the name given by a writer called Peter Quinnell to the young women, upper class mostly, rackety, louche, who wandered around literary London in the 1940s during the Blitz. And were involved with its literary magazines and had relationships with the artists and the writers and the painters who worked on them. So there are very kind of, if you're talking about social demographics, there are a very small group of people, but they were very influential and did some very interesting things. One of them, for example, married George Orwell.
Blimey.
On his deathbed in 1949.
On his deathbed?
Oh, yes. This is a woman called Sonia Brownell, who was... literally was the editorial manager of Horizon, the famous 40s literary magazine run by the equally famous literary critic Cyril Connolly. And Orwell at this point had 2 months to live, was lying in University College Hospital, London, with advanced tuberculosis, and all come September, in fact, almost as we speak, would be 70 years ago, almost now, Orwell's friends were asking each other, who is this woman? Who is Sonia? You know, and he's getting married to her next month, and he was so ill that an Archbishop of Canterbury's special license had to be procured. So the poor man couldn't leave his hospital bed in University College Hospital, London, and they had to conduct the ceremony literally as he lay there with her by his side. And so that's the kind of, when I say sort of rackety and louche, they although... they were very different people. The four I write about are called the principal four, are Sonia, a woman called Barbara Skelton, and two more called Lise Lubbock and Janetta Woolley. And though they had vastly came from sort of different parts of the world, they had very, very similar upbringings. They had sort of rackety childhoods behind them, disappearing parents, sometimes with whom they didn't get on. They'd been thrown out into the world at a very early stage, you know, living in youth hostels at the age of 16. And... they were very tough-minded and very resilient, but also very vulnerable, very, very sort of ripe for exploitation by unscrupulous men. And some of the stories of the lives they lived during the 1940s are very close to tragedy, unfortunately.
Aww. Apparently three of them had affairs with Lucian Freud.
Possibly four. Oh. Possibly four. It's very, you see, it is extraordinary. So that my, when I was sort of preparing the book, you know, obviously this is a serious book about literature, and but there's also a great deal, I'm afraid, a great deal of sort of... doubtful behaviour. And in fact, a friend of mine, when I was getting ready, said, you really ought to do a sort of flow chart, you know, who was with whom at when, at which time. And yes, certainly, it may well be that all four of them at one point had affairs with Lucian Freud, because some of them even ended up marrying the same people, you know. There's this constant sort of chain of handing on partners. Some of it is... very funny, because Barbara Skelton, who was married to Cyril Connolly, I think was he her second, third husband? I can't quite remember. You know, that's the sort of thing. I had to start the book. The opening paragraph is called A Note on Names, because they had so many, you know, that it's very difficult sometimes to track them through different decades.
Yeah.
And one of the women, Janetta Woolley, I think had six surnames. You know,
yeah, because they've got Janetta Parlade written down here.
Yeah, she ended up with Janetta Parlade when she married her. She married a Spanish marquis last time round. The other thing they did in the 1940s that makes it complicated was that if you didn't want any trouble sort of legally, or, for example, you know, booking a room in a hotel, you changed your name by deed poll.
It's
so there's any number of times people start calling themselves something else, you know, because it's legally very useful if you have the same name as the man you're going around with, even if you're not married to them. So the complexity of actually working out who was called what at which time and who they were with. But on the other side of this, is, of course, if they were sitting, they were also intimately involved, you know, with the production of 1940s literature. And they are the people who answered the telephone when Evelyn Waugh rang up about his latest contribution, or when George Orwell came into the office to discuss something he was writing. And these are the women who were sitting there watching it going on. And the point of doing the book, I think, was to, you know, to give them a voice.
We tend
to assume that they're handmaidens or bedmates or making the tea. And in fact, they did other things than this. And in some cases were intimately involved you know, in what was happening at the time. And then, of course, turn up. What is fascinating is they turn up in the literature that was written about this period.
Ah.
So that if you read Evelyn Waugh's novels set during the Second World War or Anthony Pohl's novels, you keep seeing these cameo appearances by Lost Girls disguised as other people, because obviously the writers involved have been taking notes when they were there at the time. And so 20, 30 years later, here they all are again, appearing in the fiction of the period. So they have long, long afterlives. And in fact, and some of them have literally, I mean, Janetta, who was the very last of the Lost Girls, only died last year at the age of 96. Held on.
Yeah, I was going to say, had you managed to talk to any of them then?
Well, I did. I talked to Janetta, who was very, in fact, it was terribly funny, because Janetta was completely wary of the whole project and thought it was ridiculous and there was no such thing as Lost Girls. And then when she died, I was very fortunate because her descendants allowed me, and she'd sort of left, you know, she'd left unpublished memoirs. She was a witness at Orwell's wedding to Sonia, and she'd left an account, you know, never before published, of actually sort of being there in the hospital bedroom, and someone had bought a champagne, you know, just remembering tiny little poignant fragments of detail, like the champagne bottle just lying there next to the medical paraphernalia, you know, as people toasted Orwell's health.
Yeah.
Which, of course, you know, he had 2 months to live, after which Sonia became the widow Orwell and lived another 30 years.
And did any of them appear in his books, in George Orwell's books?
Well, that's a very good question, actually, because there is a great sort of, people have for years and years been interested to know whether the character of Julia in 1984, you know, Winston Smith rebels against Big Brother and the totalitarian world of Oceania. A lot of people have thought that she is actually a portrait of Sonia, who was, you know, with whom Orwell was becoming acquainted just at the time when he wrote the novel, to whom he wrote letters asking her to come and stay on Jura, the Hebridean island, when he was living. I'm not entirely sure whether she is, but she certainly contributes something to the atmosphere in which 1984 was written. So this is the kind of effect, directly or indirectly, that these women are having on the cultural life of their time. You know, as I say, they're sitting there in offices, they're making cups of tea for famous men, but they're not going unnoticed, and they're having an impact on the kind of life and art of the time.
And was this because they all worked at Horizon, because that was the literary magazine of the time?
That's right,
it?
They were all sort of associated with it, all
right.
Sort of, and even Barbara, who didn't work at it, lived in the flat upstairs. And so, for example, Lise, who spent 8 years with Connolly, and very, I think, actually, they didn't marry him, changed name by Deepole, you know, another one of the Deepolers, Lise. And, you know, she left these very frank and sort of very interesting and down-to-earth sort of notes about, you know, sort of sitting there in the office. And Orwell would come in and complain about Connolly, you know, there's a war on, Connolly shouldn't be going off having expensive lunches at the Dorchester. And Lise thought that this was actually his way of flirting with her. You know, in fact, she said she left a very cryptic remark to the fact that Orwell was much better looking than the photographs of him sometimes suggest. And she thought this was actually Orwell's attempt to come on, you know, sort of talk about Cyril. And she would remember things like Evelyn Waugh coming in drunk, or Dylan Thomas coming in to try and borrow money, you know, because he's perpetually hard up to stand the next round of drinks. So you're getting this real sort of worm's eye view of how, I suppose, how literature almost was created,
yeah,
you know, in the 1940s. So it was fascinating to find, you know, to sort of read unpublished diaries and letters that had never previously seen the light. And one came across some extraordinary things, you know, just sort of accounts of dinner parties at which all these people had been present. And some of them, as all of them, were sort of emotionally involved at one point or another with Connolly, who had this very charisma, who had this very sort of, very charismatic and very sort of brutal in some ways in his love affairs. He always had sort of three women on the go and then blamed the other two for the trouble he was having with the third. And some of the letters that they wrote him towards the end are unbearably poignant and touching, you know, because they know he's treated them badly, they know he's done them wrong, but they respect him so much as a writer and a cultural impresario that they're always blaming themselves. And you feel like saying, no, he's worthless, leave him, go away.
Yes,
you know? Don't worry about the fact that you're hurting him, because he's hurt you so badly that, you know, you're entitled to behave in whatever way you will. So there's one chapter in the book which is just called The Invisible Worm, which is one of these women's sort of descriptions of what lurked in Connolly's vitals. You know, but she said something like, you have an invisible worm that makes you treat us all so abominably.
And he was the editor of Horizon,
Cyril Connolly. A very famous literary critic and editor of Horizon, which lasted 10 years throughout, in fact, the whole of the 1940s, and ended it. And he then went on and became an extremely sort of eminent literary critic. But the really kind of serious business of his life, you think, was going on in the 1940s with these women whom he, in some cases, shamelessly treated and exploited, but they all sort of oscillate around him. He's like this vast planet through all these beautiful, vulnerable, and admiring women sort of circulate. And one year he'll be with one of them, but while also writing letters to the other two, sort of saying, you know, oh, how I miss you, we could have had such a wonderful time. And it was quite fascinating for me to read all the sort of different accounts of this and the effect that they all had on each other in this extraordinary little society. Going on, of course, remember, while the bombs were falling, this is something that adds it an extra dimension, because it was a life lived out in the thought that you might very well die before the day was over.
Yeah.
And so on occasion, Connolly and Lees sort of came out of the Horizon office and a bomb went off literally in front of them. And the first thing they saw was a severed hand lying in the street.
No.
And then you go back to your office and you ring up George Orwell and see whether he's going to write for your next issue. It's that kind of life. You know,
yeah.
you would say goodbye to a military boyfriend, never quite knowing whether he would come back. If you heard a telegram coming through the door, you would immediately, your heart would stop.
Yeah. And did they obviously knew each other because they were all in close proximity, but were they friends? Did they get along or...?
Mostly they did, yes. You see, it's a very small and in some ways not very diverse world, because they'd all sort of known each other. They'd all been to the same kind of schools. They were all the same kind of people socially. You know, a lot of them had been to Eton. A lot of them knew each other from way back. It's a very close-knit little world. And it was a case of, you know, being to succeed, you really had to be one of us. And so all the women, all the girls, to a certain extent, were one of us. You know, they were respectably bred. They kind of knew each other. They got along. Although that didn't stop them all being bitchy about each other. In fact, that's another one of the funny things, is how bitchy they could all be about, you know, of course. And then in old age, Janetta would sort of say, well, of course, Sonia, you know, she used to think she was the editor, and she wasn't, of course. So a lot of these kind of, the touchiness sort of, you know, continued, I think, almost until death. And, of course, when Connolly died in 1974, and relays of them came to his deathbed.
Oh, I'll
bet. You know, and so there was a constant shuttle of middle-aged to elderly women going in and out. And, of course, the resentments which had been fostered in the 1940s were still going strong in the 1970s, so it was terribly difficult for everybody to sort of...
I'm
but
sure.
It was the most extraordinary and fascinating world with all these kind of, you know, and sort of... You know, people walking into parties and suddenly realise that, you know, the 18-year-old boy standing there is Lucian Freud, who 40 years later will be one of the most, you know, distinguished artists of the Western world. So
yeah. Can I just ask you one question? Is it true that one of them became the mistress of the King of Egypt, and he actually was she flogged on the steps of the royal palace? Is that what happened?
The royal. You see, Barbara Skelton is absolutely extraordinary femme fatale, who wanders through the 1940s making hay of everybody. So one of her boyfriends, which again is Peter Cornell, who I mentioned earlier, once said to her, sort of, Barbara, he said rather plaintively, why do you have to make things so difficult? And Barbara just said, I like things to be difficult. and yes, she was sent in 1943, she was sent to Cairo as what was called a cipherine, you know, working decrypting telegrams and that sort of thing and military intelligence. And being Barbara, she immediately started being taken out by wealthy Egyptians to nightclubs in Cairo. And at one of them, she met King Farouk, immediately was installed as a royal mistress. A terrible security risk. Because, you know, Egypt was a British protectorate at the time, and they weren't quite sure where Farouk's political sympathies lay. And so in the end, the Governor General had to send for and say, Miss Skelton, you simply cannot continue this relationship with King Farouk because, you know, you're a security risk and there's no knowing what might happen. And yes, their last meeting, he had very curious tastes, Farouk, and he brought out a cane and flogged her on the steps of the Royal Palace. Which he actually flogged her with, I think it was with a dressing gown cord. Barbara, who was made of stout stuff, said, I'd actually prefer a proper cane, you know, rather than this sort of... But that was the sort of thing she did. And she married Connolly in the 1950s and made his life absolute hell, you know, and left these diaries where she just pokes fun at him. And Connolly said that they lived in a little cottage in Kent where they fought like kangaroos. until she ran off with someone else and then divorced him. Oh,
they sound like very stoic ladies, they really do. And it's great that you've given them a voice.
Lovely
the book is called Lost Girls, Love, War and Literature, 1939 to 1951 by DJ Taylor. You can buy it from our website, tre.radio. And I know you've written extensively about George Orwell. Do you have a website so we can find out more?
DJ Taylor Writer. You Google DJ Taylor Writer, you'll find me. But I think it may omit the last two or three books, but there's certainly enough about me on there, I would have thought, to satisfy most people's curiosity.
Oh, great stuff. Thank you so much for being on the show.
It was great to talk to you. Thank you very
great
much
to
indeed.
Talk to you. Take care. Bye-bye.
And you. Bye-bye.